This is the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, at Google, at Stitcher, at Spotify, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or just go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Today, I am talking with Brian Riedel. He is an economist and a budget expert at the Manhattan Institute who has written widely about both Donald Trump's spending and Joe Biden's spending. We're talking on November 4th, the morning of November 4th. We don't know who the next president will be. We only know what Joe Biden has said he would spend, and we know something of what Donald Trump has spent. So we're going to talk about that. Brian Riedel, thanks for talking to Reason.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Nick.
Before we get into the stuff, it's almost like, if we talk about the election results, it will end. And I'm not sure, I kind of enjoy the moment of pause where we effectively don't have a president right now. So I want to push it off a little bit. But tell the audience a little bit about your background. You've worked for Rob Portman, a senator from Ohio who's considered a kind of centrist person. You worked at the Heritage Foundation. What's your background, and what's the most salient thing that you bring to discussions of budgets?
Well, as you said, I've been at the Manhattan Institute for 3 years, where I do budget, tax, and economics. Before that, I spent 6 years as chief economist to Rob Portman, who used to run the budget office under President Bush. So I was the budget advisor to a budget nerd.
So you know just how badly things can go wrong.
I know how badly things can go, yes. Before that, I ran budget policy for the Heritage Foundation for a decade. Also, additionally, I've done a lot of campaign work. In 2016, was the budget advisor to Marco Rubio's campaign. In 2012,
I got to talk to you. You know, sadly, I'm my own booker, but I'm questioning my choice of guest today.
Well, it may get better or worse, depending on what you think. In 2012, yes. I was Mitt Romney's budget advisor.
So you have an unbroken chain of budget problems going on here.
Yeah. Well,
can I ask why are you a Republican?
I'm a libertarian. Okay. I generally believe in small government up and down. Mm-hmm. I usually pair myself up with the most libertarian plausible candidate.
So you don't really vote very often, do you?
I end up voting for the libertarian presidential candidate often. Yeah. I go into an election planning to vote for the Republican, and then I get really angry at all the spending promises, and I usually end up voting for the libertarian.
So did you vote for Joe Jorgensen?
I did.
Yes. Where excuse me, where are you living?
I live in Mount Vernon, Virginia, right outside Washington, D.C.
A state where your vote plausibly kind of possibly mattered. So good for you for going third party there. Why are you a libertarian? I had asked, why are you a Republican? And I realize you're a small L libertarian, as am I. But what is it? Was it something in the lake waters of Wisconsin or something?
Well, my political life began when I was 14 or 15, and I was the bassist in a thrash metal band. I was the worst bassist ever. And
oh, don't say that. I'm sure there are worse.
The politicians were trying to ban rock music and impose curfews and tell me what to do.
Wait, were you
a rebellion libertarian was born?
Yeah, were you in Footloose or something? You went to University of Wisconsin undergrad, so I'm assuming you grew up in Wisconsin. Did you grow up in Wisconsin?
I grew up in northern Wisconsin, city called Appleton.
Oh my God, Appleton! Isn't that where the John Birch Society was for a while?
And it's also Joe McCarthy's hometown.
Yeah, geez, Louise. So no wonder, no wonder they were trying to ban rock music.
Yeah.
Because if we let rock music happen, who knows how this country is going to turn out?
You know, they were trying to take away my Slayer, my Iron Maiden, my Ozzy. I didn't want to find politics. Politics found me.
Oh boy, that's great. Your guitar killed fascists, right? Every bit as much as Woody Guthrie's.
Well, yeah, I mean that began my libertarianism, and then I started reading economics. I started reading about Milton Friedman, and I said, "Well, I want to keep my money too."
Yeah.
And so that's how I became a libertarian. Right. And it was actually fun because as you mentioned, I went to University of Wisconsin, which was a socialist campus.
Right.
And it was really fun kind of being on the libertarian side. On a lefty campus, I kind of like being in the minority. I like guerrilla warfare.
Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of great. I mean, the University of Wisconsin is, you know, famously the third coast of American politics. And, you know, when you're a libertarian, you don't have a lot of the baggage that conservatives have or leftists have. So it's, you know, I you know, well, we could talk all day about what, you know, God, given it's such an attractive position, smart, rooted in reality, but also idealistic, why aren't, you know, there more libertarians? And I guess we, you know, we're part of the problem then if there aren't.
There needs to be more of us. I think the Libertarian Party, I think, has had a lot of challenges. I think there's a lot of small L libertarians who are usually voting Republican because, I mean, the Libertarian Party almost, I believe, picked Vermin Supreme as their vice president this year.
You know, he was a serious candidate this year. I say that, you know, he's a man who wears a boot on his head, and he actually was making a lot of sense. But your point is well taken. Let's talk about, you know, the two major parties who, you know, demand to be taken seriously, even as they are, you know, just unbelievably bad at handling our money. We're talking, I'm on the West Coast. It's 8:15 a.m. Pacific time. It's 11:15 your time. We're not sure who the winner of the election is. It looks like it's probably going to tip towards Joe Biden, but who knows? There's going to be court battles, all of this coming out. This is a good time to talk about what has happened under Trump, what he's planning to spend in a second term if he gets it, and then let's talk about Joe Biden. Discuss Trump's spending record as a president. This is a guy who campaigned saying that he was going to wipe out the national debt in 4 years or 8 years. What actually happened while he was president?
Yeah, the king of debt promised to wipe out the national debt, which was laughable. It became especially laughable during the campaign in 2016 when he said he wouldn't touch Social Security and Medicare, which are the main drivers of the long-term debt. I mean, it showed a complete lack of familiarity with even basic budgeting. It was actually quite embarrassing. As president, he's added
totally within Republican presidential rhetoric, because you know, your former best friend Mitt Romney talked about he was going to be fiscally prudent, but he was not going to touch old age entitlements. You know what? Why
there were some reforms in the Romney budget plan to Social Security and Medicare, but not, he didn't campaign on it boldly.
Okay, so you know, Trump's campaign promises worthless. What actually happened to spending, and why under, you know, these past 4 years?
Well, the main thing that happened on spending pre-COVID was a $2 trillion blowout on discretionary spending. Mm-hmm. Both parties were complaining that the budget control caps were too tight for discretionary spending. So under President Trump, they had a bipartisan deal. The Democrats get a huge increase in domestic spending. The Republicans get a big increase in defense spending. $2 trillion over 10 years right there in discretionary spending.
Discretionary spending is spending that Congress votes on every year to, you know, continue, increase, decrease. We'll also later be talking, I'm sure, about mandatory spending, which are things that are effectively on autopilot. And that most of that is old age entitlements like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid.
Right. It was the discretionary spending that actually has to get appropriated every year by Congress. This is not only defense, it's things like K-12 education, veterans, foreign aid, public health, environment. And
as a percentage of the budget, this is something I've been writing about budget issues for about 20 years now. And I can remember it. I was thinking about this the other day. When I started, it was, you know, when you're throat clearing or explaining terms, you would say, you know, there are mandatory and discretionary aspects of the federal budget, and they each comprise about 50% of spending. That is no longer the case, right?
Yeah, discretionary spending is 30% of the budget and falling.
Yeah. So it's 70% of the budget is essentially going to happen regardless. And then 30%, which is worth fighting over, because when you're talking about, you know, the quaint old days when we spent only $4.4 trillion a year, you know, that's still 30% of that's a hell of a lot of money. But discretionary is a small and shrinking part of the budget.
It's small and shrinking, although there was a push to reverse that. Like I said, there was a $2 trillion over 10-year deal in order to at least slow down the dropping of it and push it back, that mm-hmm. that's going to be about $2 trillion over 10 years because right. they did a deal that was $200 billion for the first year, but then you're going to renew that higher amount every year. They're not going right. to ratchet it back down. So $200 billion a year becomes $2 trillion over a decade.
Right. So what else did what else happened on Trump's watch?
COVID, $3 trillion so far in spending on the pandemic has happened. That raises it up to about $5 trillion in spending above the baseline over 10 years mm-hmm. under President Trump. And then you've also, of course, on the revenue side, had about $2 trillion in tax cuts. That's how you get $7 trillion in higher debt than what is expected when the president got elected,
right?
Just from those three sources.
Can you explain, you know, we were 2019, the federal budget was something like about $4.4 trillion. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then this past year, we spent about in fiscal 2020, which ended at the end of September, we spent what, about $7 trillion?
$6.6 trillion.
Okay. So what is likely to happen? And I guess this is, you know, this is, it's all counterfactuals right mm-hmm. now in this moment. But, you know, what do you expect the spending of the federal budget to be for fiscal 2021?
The baseline is $5 trillion right now, which is still $600 billion than it was before the pandemic,
right.
just from the normal growth plus some leftover pandemic spending that can get moved into 2021. But that assumes there's no more legislation. And I think at some point, there's going to be something, even if the Republicans hold the Senate, mm-hmm. you're going to get something additionally. There's going to be some bipartisan deals on spending. So you're kind of starting at $5 billion for next year.
Right. And then we'll build on top of that. And there's almost certain to be some kind of stimulus mm-hmm. plan that will go. Trump jacked up spending I guess language matters a little bit here. Spending increased significantly under Donald Trump, as it did under George W. Bush, you know, just going back to 2001 and on from the budget mm-hmm. years that he was responsible for. There was about a 50% real increase in real spending under George Bush from when he started to when he left office. Mm-hmm. Of course, we had TARP and, you know, the financial crisis, so big stimulus bills that both Bush was part of and then also Obama kind of topped off at the end. Obama had massive spending bills, but it was relatively flat after his first year and a half in office. One canard that you hear a lot is that Democrats are actually better on spending in office than Republicans when it comes to presidents. Is that accurate or you know, what are we talking about when we talk about that?
Well, generally, this comes from the argument that deficits go down under Democratic presidents. And I've written a long breakdown of the Obama budget history. President Obama actually signed legislation that cumulatively added $5 trillion in 10-year deficits. The only reason it went down is because you're measuring it relative to a one-year spike
right.
In 2009 from the recession. Basically, the story of Obama is the recession automatically spiked the deficit from $160 billion to $1.2 trillion mm-hmm. the day he got inaugurated. What CBO says is if you do nothing, the recession ends and the deficit goes right back down to $200 billion.
Right.
Instead, it stayed above a trillion through 2012. Why? Because we had all the stimulus spending. We had $5 trillion in new costs. Now, that includes extending the Bush tax cuts. Mm-hmm. But overall, there was $5 trillion in new costs under President Obama above the baseline he inherited. All presidents generally increase spending, though. President Bush not only increased defense spending, President Bush did No Child Left Behind, a budget-busting farm bill, Medicare Part D.
Yeah, Medicare Part D, which is prescription. You know, people forget because it's already been folded into, mm-hmm. you know, just what you expect. But that was prescription drugs for rich old people on Medicare.
$400 billion over 10 years, which at the time was one of the biggest bills in decades. Now, that's just a basic day's work in Congress, but $400 billion is still a lot of money. So you had huge increases under President Bush. I think, you know, one of the differences, the Republicans cut taxes in addition to mm-hmm. the spending, but both parties have been really bad on spending. They just choose to spend in different areas.
Well, as somebody who worked for Republicans as mm-hmm. well as for the Heritage Foundation, how do you feel about tax cuts? Because, and, you know, I'll lay out my cards. Obviously, mm-hmm. I think, you know, taxes should be minimal. They should be obvious and they should be geared towards spending, you know, or towards paying for the services that, however you want to say, we decide as a society, this is what the government is going to provide. You know, tax cuts, are tax cuts always good or are they always bad? You know, how do you feel about both the Bush tax cuts, virtually all of which were extended by the Obama administration, and then the Republican tax plan that came through under Trump and is really one of the, you know, whether you think it's good or bad, is one of the legislative achievements of his term in office.
Economically, I think tax cuts are usually good as long as they're geared toward incentives to work, save, and invest. You know, tax rebates don't generally work, but, you know, making sure we don't have the highest corporate rate in the world is probably good. It'll probably increase investment. It'll probably help over the long term. But that's economically. From a budget angle, when you have deficits like we do, you have to pay for them. The Trump tax cuts absolutely should have been paid for. Look, people can disagree over what the size of government should be, whether we should have big government mm-hmm. or small government. But whatever size government you have, at a certain point, you have to pay for it. And so if the Republicans are not going to cut spending, then at some point, they have to at least somewhat align taxes with spending. And I think Republicans are kind of deluding themselves in not having the guts to touch spending, but thinking that it is even remotely sustainable to keep cutting taxes. And if you look at the budget over the next 30 years, we're projected to run a deficit of $104 trillion over the next 30 years. That is not remotely sustainable. At Right. some point, you can't keep cutting taxes or even not raising them if you're not going to address the spending. So while I like a lot of the tax cuts, I think a lot of them are necessary. If you're not going to pay for them through either spending cuts or tax offsets, it is not remotely sustainable.
And one of the ways I like to think about it, too, is that because most government money is not, or most government spending is not paid for through taxes, or an increasing share of it is not, it's kind of like government by Groupon, where, you know, we're being told, you know, you can get a dollar's worth of government stuff for only 60 cents or 70 cents mm-hmm. on the dollar. Of course, you know, when you go to the supermarket and they say, you know, you have a Groupon coupon where you can get, you know, a dollar's worth of ice cream for 70 cents, you want more of it, or you're more likely on the sure. margin to call for more of it. So that, weirdly, from a libertarian point of view, and I routinely get roasted for this and many other, you know, heresies, but it's almost like we should insist on full payment of government services in the year they're delivered, because I think demand would go down for government.
Absolutely. It's government spending on the cheap.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But thankfully we have, you know, many children. We have an increasing number of children in the country who will be able to pay for that and pass it on. It's a cycle of violence, really. But let's, what about Trump? As he was running for reelection, Donald Trump was very vague about his plans for a second term. But what is your sense of, if Trump manages to win re-election, and he's, you know, he's still in it, what is spending going to look like under a second term Trump, with a Republican Senate most likely and a Democratic House?
With a split government, you're not going to see that much change from the baseline. I think in the short term, you're going to get more pandemic aid, more recession aid, not nearly the $3 trillion the Democrats want, but maybe another $1 trillion over the next year or so. From there, President Trump has campaigned on $2 trillion in infrastructure. Joe Biden campaigned on $2 trillion in infrastructure. Mm-hmm. There might be a bipartisan infrastructure deal at some point. Now,
which
you know as well as I do.
It'll be $4 trillion.
$4 trillion, right? Exactly. Yeah. They'll get together.
Let's compromise.
You know the joke in right now, infrastructure week has kind of become yes. a punchline in Washington. They're always yeah. talking about pivoting to infrastructure. But if you're looking at what, if anything happens, where would it be? Infrastructure might be one of the places where both sides are looking to spend money after the pandemic. There also might be another of those crazy deals where Republicans get defense spending, Democrats get more non-defense. And then on the tax side, both sides are converging towards more low income credits, expanding the child tax credit, expanding the earned income tax credit.
How do you feel about those? You had talked about you're not a big fan of tax rebates, tax credits. Tax credits, independent of what they are credits for, do you like tax credits? And then let's talk about, you know, the specifics of, you know, here you had some kids, so we'll give you more money, even though they're already born, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, macroeconomically, they don't really create growth. If you're just giving people $1,000, that doesn't change work, saving, and investing. So you have to look at it more as a welfare program. Does it make families better off? Maybe, maybe not. The EITC, I think, is more justifiable. The earned income tax credit does actually help people work because it's contingent on work. The EITC is good economics. The child credit is welfare.
Although the EITC also has what a mispayment rate or a misapplied payment rate of something like 30%.
30%, right?
It's extraordinarily wasteful. Yeah, so $3 out of 10 is just going to somebody who shouldn't actually be getting it under the terms of the program.
It is a grossly inefficient program, yet at the same time, at least the 70% that isn't wasted it's more effective than, say, increasing the minimum wage to $15, which is usually how Democrats are trying to raise incomes.
The earned income tax credit, and I get, you know, it's been so long since I've talked to an actual budget nerd. I'm kind of diverting into side issues here a bit, but that is generally that started under Richard Nixon, is that right? Or early 70s Republicans.
Yes.
And it is widely considered the kind of grotesque baby birthed ultimately by Milton Friedman flirting with a negative income tax. We kind of got the earned income tax credit. Is that, you know, would we be better off, you know, just from a budget consideration ultimately, and possibly even, you know, some social considerations, to just say, instead of that, we're just going to give people straight cash payments of a certain amount, not necessarily a universal basic income, but something like a guaranteed minimum income?
Not if you want people to work. I mean, the point of the EITC is to encourage work. The more hours you work, the bigger the check you get up to a certain point. Any sort of universal basic income or just basic cash payment that's divorced from work is going to have the opposite effect. It's going to make people need to work less. And so I think it depends on what the goal is. If the goal is just to end material poverty, you can do that by writing checks. Mm-hmm. If the purpose is more to get people working, self-sufficiency, all of that, I think you want to make it contingent on that, on some sort of work effort. It really just depends on what your goal is.
Let's talk about Joe Biden's spend. Is there anything else to say about Donald Trump a second term? You know, he has been promising infrastructure week. Mm-hmm. It is like Guns N' Roses promising, you know, Chinese democracy or the Beach Boys Smile album. When it comes out, it'll be 30 years too late and it'll be disappointing, except to true fans. And even they'll be lying about how much they like it. Is there anything else in Trump or coming out of the Republicans that is on the docket for a second Trump term?
Very little. I mean, the Republicans as a whole have virtually no agenda. I mean, there could be some more Buy America manufacturing kind of compromise with the Democrats, maybe a little bit on family leave, a little bit on trade. For the most part, though, the GOP essentially has no real agenda. And so I think in the short term, again, you're mostly just looking at pandemic aid, maybe infrastructure, maybe some tax credits. You might, the next 4 years under split government may be a pretty quiet 4 years from a policy level. There's just not much of a Republican agenda.
So a while ago, within the past couple of weeks, I guess, you put up a great piece at the Manhattan Institute's website about Joe Biden, which I shamelessly have quoted from, and I guess it originally appeared at the Dispatch. On September 3rd, 2020, Joe Biden has an $11 trillion spending plan. Can he enact it? Let's start with breaking down that $11 trillion spending plan that candidate Biden, and possibly, you know, by the end of this podcast, President-elect Biden had. What went into his $11 trillion spending plan?
Well, before we even go into that, just compare the size of that. John Kerry ran on $2 trillion over 10 years. Barack Obama ran on $1 trillion. Hillary Clinton ran on $2 trillion in spending over 10 years. Joe Biden ran on $11 trillion.
Like, and this is, I mean, yeah, you know, and think about these numbers. It reminds me of, like, you know, it took people, once track, you know, kind of the mile became a track event of note, running the mile, it took decades for somebody to approach and then beat the 4-minute mile. And, you know, you would hear, mm-hmm. oh, it's impossible. You know, the human body can't run that fast, et cetera. And then once it was broken, like within months, a bunch of other people had broken 4 minutes, and it keeps going down. And it's like the seal has been broken on, you know, even $1 trillion over 10 years is like an insane amount of money. But mm-hmm. like you go from that to $11 trillion and it's like, holy shit, this is, you know, let loose the Kraken has awakened and everything.
Right. But the Overton window has shifted so far. Bernie Sanders ran on $97 trillion over 10 years. Elizabeth Warren ran on $45 trillion over 10 right. years.
So we're, so all what of you're sudden, saying
Biden's a moderate.
Yeah, we're getting a bargain. Because and this is one of the things that you hear constantly. And, you know, and this is, I mean, there's a Republican version of this, too, but that Joe Biden is a centrist. He's the moderate in the race. And it's like, moderate compared to somebody who, you know, like Bernie Sanders, yeah, but like moderate compared to a baseline of, you know, 4 years ago with Hillary Clinton, it's nuts.
No, this is the Bolsheviks versus the Mensheviks. Yeah, I mean, yes, the Mensheviks are the moderates, but I mean, we're all so far to the left right now. I mean,
yeah,
you know, it's funny, like, you know, used to be $1 trillion policy would shock people. And now $1 trillion policy gets laughed at for being insufficient.
Yeah, but that was, I mean, in the financial crisis, you know, the $787 billion mm-hmm. stimulus bill, like we knew it had to be less than $1 trillion because $1 trillion would have been laughed out and it had to be, you know, substantial. And you know, mm-hmm. when people go back, kind of budgetary archaeologists go back and excavate that, it's fascinating to see that, you know, where the 787 figure came from was basically, it sounded good, you know, and exactly. then let's work towards it. It's very disturbing, but you were saying.
Yeah. So in terms of the amounts of what's in, there's healthcare is about $1.7 trillion, health and ACA expansions, lowering the Medicare age to 60, $2 trillion for climate and infrastructure, $1 trillion to expand Social Security and SSI, mm-hmm. $750 billion for K-12, $750 billion for student loans and college, free tuition for community colleges. And then you keep going. There's housing, mm-hmm. Buy America, family leave, opioids. And let's not forget, $3 trillion Biden has endorsed in stimulus. So right. when you put all that together, you get $11 trillion over 10 years. And any one of those would be the biggest initiative of a normal presidency. Biden has about 10 or 11 proposals that would be the biggest initiative of a normal presidency.
You know, when you look at his campaign site, there's a tab called Joe's Vision, and it kind of lays out everything that he's going to do. And it is virtually endless. I mean, it's like a Thomas Pynchon novel. It you know, and it's at some point, I think, you know, you start reading it over again, and it just keeps getting longer and longer. Is he serious about that kind of stuff? Or is it that we live in a world, and, you know, and this is something that Donald Trump does, where you just kind of run off at the mouth. And, you know, people take you perhaps seriously, but not literally.
I think a lot of this is just basically he has to satisfy different bases. If you're a Democrat, you have to have K-12, you have to have student loans and college aid for urban individuals. You have to have Buy America for blue collar workers. You have to have housing for the cities. You have to have lower the Medicare age for older individuals. There's so many boxes you have to check with a $1 trillion spending program if you're running for president as a Democrat. In reality, they don't have the bandwidth, even if they control the government, to do even half of this. They're all too big. They're all too bold. They couldn't possibly do all of them. You know, I think back to when Obama controlled the whole government with the Democratic Congress in mm-hmm. 2009 and 2010, they did stimulus and healthcare. And people right. look back and go, well, why didn't they do climate when they had the chance? Why didn't they do more for infrastructure when they had the chance? Because there's only so much bandwidth, even if you run the show. So realistically, this is about checking boxes with different Democratic constituencies. There's no chance they could do it.
Okay, and that is assuming full control of the government. It looks pretty secure that mm-hmm. the Republicans will hold the Senate, and Mitch McConnell's hands may be failing him, but he still knows how to block, body block legislation. So what do you think, you know, assuming a Biden presidency, a slim Republican majority mm-hmm. in the Senate, and a smaller but still significant Democratic majority in the House, what do you foresee, over the first couple of years of a potential Biden presidency? Well,
I imagine, again, a little more pandemic aid, just like if mm-hmm. Trump wins with a divided government, there's going to be some more pandemic aid, probably in the $500 to $1 trillion range, $500 billion to $1 trillion. Mm-hmm. I think then again, you might be able to get an infrastructure deal. You know, but if Biden really wants climate and infrastructure, there's a lot of Republican senators who love mm-hmm. pavement and they yeah. love bringing home the bacon. So I think that's probably where they go next, again, is infrastructure. Mm-hmm. I can see also Biden really having some push with his Buy America initiative.
Right.
With
some Which is already part of Trump's and Republican rhetoric now.
Exactly.
And programs, yeah.
And you know, there are some Republicans, the Marco Rubios, who I think are going to be looking more at policy.
You know, not only is Marco Rubio terrible, but everybody who ever worked for Marco Rubio is just, why are we still talking about Marco Rubio? No, but what does Marco Rubio and that style of Republican love about a kind of Buy American type of program? Especially because on a certain level, they want to be, and I'm thinking also of Ted Cruz. And hell, even somebody like Rand Paul, I mean, these were Tea Party Republicans. Mm-hmm. They were a different breed, you know, young guns and all of that kind of stuff. And they understood basic economics. They understood that free trade is generally good, but they also love Buy America. What's going on there in the Republican psyche?
The Republicans have come to the conclusion that their base is working class, blue collar voters rather than suburban professionals. Mm-hmm. And that they're gonna give benefits to the people who they see as their base. This is a viewpoint that the Tea Party was based, in hindsight, they will say, more on frustration with stimulus and TARP mm-hmm. than any sort of actual small government belief system. And that as long as the Republican base is going to shift into these lower income, more blue collar workers, the Republicans are going to give them what they want, which is they're going to steer benefits their way. They're going to get farm subsidies. They're going to get manufacturing aid, tariffs, Buy America. And it seems to be one of those areas where the political self-interest comes first and they'll look up the arguments later.
Are they wrong to, a couple of things. One are farmers and people who are directly involved in the kind of production and distribution of food is one thing. There's always these odd moments when you start to look at, you know, deep red states, places or generally like Kansas or Nebraska, who, you know, are the backbone of America, but they actually get much more from the federal government than they cough in taxes. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are welfare, welfare addicts, if anybody mm-hmm. is from a federal government standpoint. That's one thing. Then when you start to talk about kind of working class America, blue collar America, is that the Republican constituency or are they chasing, you know, a kind of vision of themselves that is not only a dead end demographically, but also is not actually who's voting for them?
Well, the exit polls from last night suggest that Republicans still did the best among those who earn between $100,000 and $200,000 a year. But they're still kind of, I think, chasing lower income individuals because in certain states in the Midwest, that is their backbone. Yeah. And also, I think they're seeing the Democrats do so much better with a lot of the professional class as well. I think Republicans have had some success with them building a Trump coalition, and they're also chasing them, I think, kind of forced to from a view that upscale voters seem to be trending more Democratic overall, despite Trump doing okay among the 100,000.
Democrats are doing better with educated, with college educated mm-hmm. plus, and that's a growing share of the population. But it seems odd to me, just from a kind of strategic point of view, that Republicans, Hillary Clinton won overwhelmingly households making less than $50,000. Mm-hmm. But it seems like that who is a lot of what Republicans are targeting, kind of like, you know, Archie Bunker types who don't really exist in the same numbers that they did. White Archie Bunker types. It just strikes me as odd.
Yeah, it's a white working class focus right now from the Republicans. Again, I think politics seem to be pushing them a bit in that direction. Ultimately, though, they got to appeal better to all different groups, or they're going to be a minority party for a long time.
Well, and that is one weirdly, and this isn't the time to go into it. It's fascinating that Donald Trump actually, who has been reviled by everybody, to the left of Bill Kristol, mm-hmm. As the most racist, xenophobic president ever, is actually showing large gains among Black mm-hmm. and Latino voters, which is making people on the left kind of pull their hair out. Part of Biden's plan and your critique of Biden's plan, which was in the Dispatch originally in September, mm-hmm. it's a solid piece of work, was also about taxes. Talk about Biden's tax plan that he ran on, that he won the nomination on, essentially. What was that, and what does that look like in an era of divided government?
Biden is promising a $3.5 to $4 trillion tax increase, which would be the biggest tax increase since shortly after World War II. The first thing to note is, of course, when you're promising $11 trillion in spending and $3.5 trillion in taxes, you still have a $7.5 trillion gap. So even with the biggest tax hike since around 1950, you're still $7.5 trillion short. In terms of what he's raising taxes on, of course, he has famously promised nobody earning under $400,000 will pay a cent, which is interesting. If $400,000 is now where they're setting the
line. Well, this is like, it used to be $100,000 or whatever. It's just the inflation of, these price tags on everything. It's amazing to me. It's like, I feel like we're in 2001 and we're Star Wars, and we're just hitting that warp speed where everything just gets blurry and you show up in a different universe altogether.
I had an op-ed in the Daily Beast last week where I explained that if you look at the Biden plan and a lot of the Democratic plans, most of the spending actually goes to the professional class. Mm-hmm. Those earning $100,000 to $200,000 actually get most of the spending under the left, and yet they don't get a tax hike. So really, they're the ones who are going to be benefiting the most. Biden sets the taxes at $400,000. And then gives a lot of the spending to the $100,000 to $200,000.
What are the taxes that he's increasing though?
He would raise the corporate tax, which went from 35% to 21%, back up to 28%, mm-hmm. which would bring it back again, probably to among the largest in the industrialized world. He would start to apply Social Security taxes, reapply Social Security taxes at $400,000. Importantly, that would not be inflation adjusted over time. Hmm. So while right now you pay Social Security taxes up to $137,000 and it grows at inflation, eventually it would grow up to $400,000. So eventually you'd have Social Security taxes on all income. For people earning over $1 million, you'd pay 40% capital gains and dividend taxes. He would also, for those in the highest tax bracket, you'd lose a lot of tax deductions. You would lose the small business deduction that was created in 2017. A lot of assorted corporate taxes on international income. Of the $4 trillion, about $4 trillion in gross tax increases mm-hmm. before the tax cuts, about half of it is on the corporate side. Mm-hmm. The corporate taxes are enormous. In fact, the corporate taxes in terms of revenue are 6 times bigger than the corporate tax cuts in 2017 under President Trump.
We hear a lot whenever corporate taxes get discussed, the one thing you from the left you hear, oh God, these, companies are Donald Trump himself doesn't pay taxes. Donald Trump Incorporated, Apple doesn't pay taxes. These companies that are making billions and bazillions and gazillions of dollars pay nothing in taxes. What is wrong about saying, okay, we're going to raise that from 0% to 28%.
It is very different to say we're going to go after the tax preferences that keep Apple from paying taxes in a given year. You can do that versus a broad-based, large corporate tax increase that affects everybody. And I think overall, one of the goals of the 2017 tax cuts on the corporate side was to bring income back home. We had a system where it was much more profitable for companies to relocate overseas, move their headquarters overseas, and that's what a lot of them were doing. And so I think
we had that horrible, and now I'm just remember these are all like deep album cuts of weird policy of that horrible moment when Burger King, a good American company, fast food, crummy fast food franchise based in Miami, sold itself to Tim Hortons, the Canadian donut drive-through company, in order to basically pay less in taxes, right?
Yeah, and I mean, look at the beer companies. The biggest, I believe the biggest American beer company is Sam Adams. Every other beer company has relocated abroad as well. Right. So I think if we want to close loopholes and kind of create more of a minimum tax for corporations, I think you can do that without broadly raising tax rates across the board so high that you become the highest tax rate in the world again.
And it's, I mean, people are acting, or certainly like Joe Biden is acting as if, well, you know, corporations, they're like, oh, well, the tax rate went up, so we'll just keep things exactly the same and pay more. We live in a world of global capital, right? So they relocate whatever they need to in order to go to a place that has a lower tax rate. And essentially, the idea behind you know, having a more competitive corporate tax rate is that you don't chase companies out of the United States. Is that does that actually happen?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, like I said, up until the 2017 tax cuts, corporate inversions were a huge problem. We were losing beer companies. We were losing Burger King. We were losing all sorts of companies. So many companies were often becoming Irish or something like that. And it was so easy to sell yourself or to relocate. And all you got to do is move your headquarters. You don't actually have to fire workers in America. All you have to do is move your headquarters and you can cut your corporate taxes drastically. And it almost got to the point where it would be corporate malpractice not to. And now we, after the 2017 tax cuts, we now have a corporate tax hike that's about the average of the OECD if you count state taxes. We're not a tax haven. We're about the average. So if you add 7 points like Biden wants to, we bump back up to being about the biggest. I think we kind of match France and Germany to be the biggest.
Does Biden in his tax increases talk at all about getting rid of or reinstating deductions for state and local taxes? One of the I thought one of the best elements of the Republican plan, and obviously this was a way to kind of screw blue states, but was to limit the ability of people to deduct state and local taxes off their federal dollars.
It's amazing that this is the one thing the Democrats have gone after in the 2017 tax cuts. For all their complaints about tax cuts for the rich and the estate tax and capital gains, the first thing the Democrats voted on in the House and Senate was getting rid of the $10,000 cap on the state and local deduction. The one thing that actually raised taxes on the rich is the one thing the Dems tried to get rid of.
But that's because they, you know, California, New York, Massachusetts, Maryland. This is Chuck Schumer. I live in New York now. I pay taxes, and I had moved there from Ohio, and I was like, Chuck Schumer was the most reliable guy, you know, to put through alternative minimum tax patches, whatever he could do to do constituent service for rich New Yorkers so that they paid less in overall taxes.
Yeah, this is their base. Their base is the professional class. And Biden has been cagey. On the one hand, he says we're going to get rid of the whole 2017 tax cuts. And then he says, well, we're going to only get rid of the 2017 tax cuts for those earning under 400 or those earning over 400,000. He seems to support congressional Democratic efforts right now to get rid of the SALT cap, but he's been a little cagey on it. But overall, I would expect under a Biden presidency, there will be a push to get rid of that cap and basically provide a $620 billion tax cut that goes overwhelmingly to the rich.
And does he talk at all about the changes in the deductibility of mortgage interest payments, which is another fascinating. And this was where Trump and the Republicans, I think, were kind of brilliant. And this got lost in a lot of the commentary of saying, you know what, like, if you have a mortgage, you're like in a special class of American and you're getting free money. Like, why should you be able to deduct your mortgage interest? That's something that, I mean, by definition, only property owners get to do.
Yeah, I mean, other countries don't have a mortgage interest deduction,
and they're all homeless. Canada is homeless, right? You know, yeah, France is homeless. It's like
Biden would slightly go after it in saying that while he would raise the top tax rate to back to 39.6, he says that those earning over $400,000 could only deduct at a 28% rate. So you wouldn't be able to get the full deduction. You'd only be able to get about a three-quarter deduction, which is not particularly aggressive. It's not like he's trying to get rid of the mortgage interest deduction. He's tweaking it. Overall, though, over time, the mortgage interest deduction is on pace to kind of phase out a little bit. Mm-hmm. As long as the standard deduction keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, eventually more people won't feel a need to itemize.
With a Republican Senate, what kind of tax increase? You talked before about what kind of spending increases might happen with a Biden president, with a Republican Senate. What kind of tax increase might happen, assuming Joe Biden becomes president?
Well, I think with a Republican Senate, you're not going to get any significant tax increases. I can't see there being a deal on that. I can see there being tax shifts where we pay for new tax cuts, or we pay for like EITC changes and child credit changes with certain small revenue increases. But I don't think the Republicans at this point are ready to sign off on tax increases. Mm-hmm. One issue that will come up, though, is the first notable part of the 2017 tax cuts will expire in 2022 when they start losing 100% business expensing. That's going to start to slowly phase out in 2022. That's where you might have to start to see a little negotiation between the Republicans mm-hmm. and Democrats if they want to keep business expensing.
So under, you know, and this is, you know, we can take this to the bank or to the poorhouse, that under a Trump presidency or a Biden presidency, the debt is going to increase no matter what.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, the deficit's not going to come back below $1 trillion again, I don't believe.
Explain why debt is bad for the country. And especially we're in an age now of modern monetary theory, mm-hmm. which is really like, you know, it's not the theory we want, but it's the theory we need in a period of, you know, just fiscal incompetence and just drunken sailor spending. But why is the national debt? Why is it bad to have a national debt that's the equivalent of the size of the annual economy, and it's getting bigger?
Well, let me give this the simplest reason. Let's move away from the economic consequences of whether or not it crowds out investment. Let's just look at the interest cost. If you start right now, interest rates are low. But if interest rates spike, the interest cost could absolutely destroy the federal budget. For every point interest rates rise, it costs about $1.5 or $2 trillion over the decade. Over the next 30 years, we already are assuming that even if for every point rates rise, it's going to cost $30 trillion in interest over 30 years. So we're on case to hit 195% of GDP over the next 30 years. At even 4% interest rates, which is about what CBO assumes at that point, you're paying 8% of GDP in interest, which is $1.6 trillion. If you keep going up, 195% of GDP, next point interest rates rise, you're up to 260% of GDP. Interest rates rise one point, you're up to 320% of GDP. You can't borrow that much money. You cannot borrow 200%.
But can't you just print it or manufacture it?
Not without inflation. Without inflation. Right now, the Federal Reserve monetized 60% of the borrowing last year. We borrowed $3.1 trillion. The Fed essentially monetized $1.7 trillion.
Explain what monetizing the debt means.
Essentially, we funded it through the printing press. The Federal Reserve didn't directly lend money to the Treasury, but the Treasury lent money. The Treasury borrowed money from the public, and then the Fed put money out into the public doing bond trading. Overall, though, you cannot have the Federal Reserve monetize trillions and trillions every year forever without significant inflation. So then you're faced with the issue of huge tax increases to pay these interest costs, which are going to be the biggest cost in the budget in about 20 years. Interest is going to be the biggest line item in the budget, even if interest rates stay low, because the principal gets so big. So then at a certain point, the bond market gets nervous. They see the debt rising that much, and they start to demand higher interest rates. That's when the cost starts to go up.
That is all from a kind of budgeting perspective. What is the effect? And, you know, and it's massive and foreboding. I mean, this mm-hmm. is, you know, we're the Titanic and it's just icebergs everywhere on the horizon. What is the effect of persistent, growing national debt on economic growth, if any?
At a certain point, it begins to crowd out investment spending. Now, people can say, well, in a global economy, we're awash in savings. But we're not always going to be in that situation. So what happens is the more money, the more of the savings that government soaks up for its spending, the less savings is available to go to businesses to borrow for investment, for families to borrow for houses, for car loans, business loans, auto loans. There's only so much savings to go around. And so at a certain point, you know, CBO says that by 2050, the GDP will be $6,000 lower per capita than if we stabilize the national debt. That's adjusted for inflation. $6,000 per capita just from the economy growing more slowly because the savings are going to the government for investment or for spending rather than businesses for investment. And, you know, again, it's easy to say, well, the whole world's awash in savings. But when the debt increases as much as it's supposed to, $100 trillion over the next 30 years, eventually you start to constrain the savings we have. Some people will say, well, the rest of the world's going to keep lending to us. The problem with that, China and Japan have not added their lending to America since 2011.
And what percentage of foreign debt do they have? It's like around 10% or so?
At the end of 2011, China and Japan held $2.2 trillion in our debt. Right mm-hmm. now, they hold $2.3
trillion. Right.
So back then, it was about 20% of a $10 trillion debt. Now, it's about $20 trillion. So now, actually, it's gone from 20% to 10% because the debt doubled while they remained at about $2.2 trillion.
I mean, you read that or people who follow this read that as a sign that they're like, hey, you know what, we're cutting off the spigot here.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, China and Japan have essentially stopped lending to us. In fact, the $3 trillion we borrowed last year, virtually zero came from international. Zero.
We got so we're finding the suckers close to home, right?
Right. 60% of it came from the Federal Reserve and 40% of it came from domestic savings.
What is the best way to stabilize the debt? I mean, you know, and obviously I agree with you and I hope, mm-hmm. you know, one of the consternations of the past 4 years, I think, has been an almost absolute, on everybody's part, an absolute lack of serious policy discussion, certainly about budgeting, but about all sorts of stuff. What are the ways to stabilize the debt or actually start to reduce it or not, you know, reduce its growth, at the very least, reduce it in absolute terms that will not tank the economy?
Gradual reforms to Social Security and Medicare are probably the best way to do it. It has to be, you can't do anything drastic. You can't drastically raise taxes without hurting the
economy. I got to tell you right now, the libertarian in me wants to do something drastic, but
macroeconomically, it would be a challenge to drastically raise taxes or drastically cut spending. Ultimately, Social Security and Medicare drive the entire long-term debt. The numbers are amazing. The Social Security and Medicare numbers are the problem. You cannot get the debt under control. Just to give you some numbers on that, the general revenue transfers that are needed to go into Social Security and Medicare to pay full benefits mm-hmm. were $400 billion last year. It'll be $1.5 trillion a decade from now. That's why the deficit rises.
I'm really excited because, you know, in the before time scenario, I would be retiring in about a decade. It seems like a really good time to retire.
Yeah,
but
this is what's driving. Yeah. This is why, even if you set aside the pandemic, the deficit goes from $1 trillion to $2 trillion over the next decade because mm-hmm. the general revenue transfers into Social Security and Medicare go from 400 to 1.5 over the next 30 years. Again, I mentioned that we have $104 trillion deficits projected by CBO. $101 trillion of that is Social Security and Medicare transfers and the interest.
Wow.
So that's where, if you want to stabilize the debt, gradual reforms to Social Security and Medicare, while...
And that means stuff like increasing the age at which you can access full, you know, what is, you know, contemporary full levels of Social Security benefits, increasing co-pays and premium payments on Medicare, things like that.
Exactly. Medicare premiums are probably going to have to rise. Social Security trim benefits for upper income individuals, raise the age. Democrats will want to tax more Social Security or raise Social Security taxes as well. Mm-hmm. You have to do that. And you can do it somewhat gradually. In order for the political stability. That said, you can't wait 5, 10, 15 years. And what you can't do is say, we're going to grandfather out everybody under the age of 55 or 50 or whatever, because at that point, it's too late. You've grandfathered out all the baby boomers. The baby boomers are already retiring. Mm-hmm. It's too late. You kind of
and
have
we're
to
living
start
longer.
People now.
So exactly. I say that as a, I was born in 1963, so I'm at the tail end of the baby boom. And in that beautiful moment in time where all of the benefits will have run out, but the new plan won't have started. So I'm very much looking forward to being penniless in my early retirement.
Yeah, if somebody who lives to 90 will spend one third of their adult life in taxpayer-funded retirement, that's just not sustainable.
So you're calling for a kind of Logan's Run scenario then, where we maybe you don't die at 30, but maybe at 60, that could also work.
You know, actually, I've had some disturbing conversations with people who've said, now, is COVID helping Social Security and Medicare finances? And I don't even want to get into
that. We already got rid of, you know, we cut smoking rights. So we need something to thin the Social Security herd. What do you think it will take? And this is more of a prognostication than a policy prescription. What do you think it will take for the country? And this is not a Republican or a Democratic mm-hmm. problem, because nobody wants to talk about this stuff, but to actually take that, you know, this gradual frog in the pot being boiled problem, like how do we get a better handle on it? We're not going to get out in front of it, but where we're not just totally up against the wall at the worst time possible.
I think there's one of two paths to fixing this. Number one, you need a Ross Perot kind of person mm-hmm. who comes and gets everybody motivated about it. I don't see that on the horizon right now, because Democrats don't want to touch these programs and Republicans increasingly don't want to touch these right. programs, because their working class base is more dependent on them. If that's the case, you need the economy to force action. You need the bond market to get nervous and start to raise interest rates. The stock market start to get nervous. You kind of need, if the economy starts to get sluggish, interest rates start to rise, the bond market gets nervous, that's what can force action. The problem is, by that point, you're already kind of beginning a fiscal crisis mm-hmm. and you have a lot less wiggle room and you have to be a lot more drastic, which is why I would love for there to be somebody who can motivate people to take this seriously now. But you know how things go in democracies. You usually wait until there's a crisis and then do something drastic.
Is there any comfort to be drawn from other countries that have reformed their entitlement spending?
A lot of them have just raised taxes through the roof. There have been some reforms in Europe, little tweaks to try to bring some market forces. But the main way Europe runs is they have generous safety nets, generous Social Security and Medicare type programs that are funded with enormous payroll taxes mm-hmm. and value added taxes that go as high as 20-25%. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, if we don't do anything on Social Security and Medicare, the budget trends look so bad over the next 20 or 30 years that it is almost guaranteed that we essentially end up with a European tax system to match our European spending priorities,
which
of
is
that, and payroll tax.
Yeah, it's fascinating that people in America, particularly on the left, complain that our taxes system is not progressive enough. But compared to OECD countries, we've basically got the most progressive tax system in the world. The very rich pay, you know, or the richer upper income people pay a lot more than they do as a percentage of total tax revenue than in Europe.
Yeah, the big difference between the U.S. and Europe is that in America, the middle class and the poor pay almost nothing. In Europe, the middle class pays enormous payroll and value added taxes, which is what, which leaves us with by far the most progressive tax code in the OECD. And I think this is kind of the Democrats' key to success. They promise European spending and European socialism while pretty much pairing it with Barry Goldwater style taxes for the middle class and the poor. They tell them the rich can fund socialism. So that makes it, it's very appealing to a lot of families. But in reality, this is what differentiates us from Europe. We just, Europe taxes the middle class to death. The United States doesn't tax them barely at all. I believe for the middle income quintile, the average federal income tax rate is about 3% of their actual income.
Are you optimistic about the next 4 years? We don't know. Again, we're talking on Wednesday, November 4th. We don't know who the president is going to be. We're not certain of the makeup of the Senate. You know, how are you feeling? Optimistic, pessimistic? Is kind of like, you know, it depends on the last drug that I took.
I am more optimistic than I was when I thought the Democrats were going to run the table. I think we're not going to get any real progress over the next 4 years against most of our problems. We're going to get mostly gridlock, but gridlock is a lot better than digging the hole deeper. And when I looked at Biden wanting $11 trillion in spending, I mean, that just, when you start out with a baseline deficit of $16 trillion and you add $11 trillion in spending, at least we may not be digging the hole deeper. But we will lose valuable time to fix a lot of problems. The, you know, Social Security and Medicare are going to get a lot worse over 4 years. The boomers are going to get 4 years older. I think overall, it's just going to maybe be a do nothing few years, which sadly, with where we are, do nothing is better than what a lot of what Washington is typically doing.
Well, we're going to leave it there. This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. I'm Nick Gillespie, and we've been speaking with Brian Riedel of the Manhattan Institute about budget and tax woes. Brian, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Nick. This was fun.
Thank you for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there and check out the Reason Roundtable and the Soho Forum debates.